What you're about to hear sounds like an advertisement, but NEFJC does not accept any financial support for promotion. We are entirely funded by donations from our users. Arcana asked to advertise, and the members of Freely Filtered are airing this promotion without compensation because they believe in Arcana's mission.
Hey, this is Joel Toff recording another promotion with Arcana about their free APOL1 testing. We've got Dr. Daryl Crenshaw. Dr. Crenshaw, why don't you tell me a little bit about your practice?
Thanks, Joe. So we're a practice out of Thomasville, Georgia.
And I've never heard of I know one city in Georgia, and it's Atlanta. What's Thomasville like?
So Thomasville is in South Georgia, Joel, and it's the most southern county actually in the state of Georgia before you reach the Florida line.
Is it a rural practice or is it more of a kind of an urban?
Thomasville is a very rural town. It's about a population of about 40,000. 40,000 to 50,000.
Wow. Okay,
but the hospital institution here is pretty up to date for a town of 40,000. We have pretty much every discipline other than thoracic surgery.
And so, how big is your practice? How many other doctors are there?
So there are three other docs.
Mm-hmm. So you know what we're here is we're here to talk about this APOL1 testing. So how are you incorporating APOL1 testing into your practice?
So it's been very exciting. And so from our perspective, the way we use the test, we first of all stratify patients, particularly anyone of African ancestry. And so once we identify them, we collect data, and particularly regarding the family history of the patient. So if there's any outstanding family history other than diabetes, then we're more inclined to go ahead and initiate the APOL1 testing. We understand, you know, some of the limitations in doing that, because obviously we have to make sure that they don't have any other concomitant diseases. So this is why we rely heavily upon our county laboratories in Little Rock under the leadership of Dr. Larson, because, you know, once we send our biopsy specimens to them, it really helps to see if we can have the diagnosis of focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. And so once we identify that, then we know that they're probably at a higher risk of having APOL1.
Tell me, what's that meeting like after you get a positive, when you get somebody who's going to be homozygous for a high-risk allele? How does that usually go, and what's kind of the patient's typical reaction?
It can go both ways. You know, in actuality, you know, ironically, we've had patients be very excited about it because they can now have a finger point as to why they've seen this you know, this predisposition of kidney disease, not only in the actual patient, but in their families. And so it actually is a sigh of relief for many of the patients. And interestingly enough, Joel, I say that
they have a reason.
They have a reason. You know, they found out the reason, you know, for, you know, many decades, they've seen, you know, this dilemma with kidney disease be burdensome throughout their, you know, throughout their family tree. And it's tears of joy. You know, tears of joy, because they now know why, you know, their mother or their grandmother actually passed away with kidney disease.
Okay, Dr. Crenshaw, I want to flip this around, and I want to kind of ask, you know, right now we don't have any specific therapies that we can throw at this APOL1 mediated kidney disease. So how are you using this? When you get the positive, how is that changing your approach to these patients?
It's allowing me, number one, to be super aggressive. We have some medicines now at hand that we can really utilize. You know, traditionally the ACE inhibitors and the angiotensin receptor blockers, you know, they've been tried and true now for many decades. But now, you know, we have SGLT2 inhibitors, you know, try to incorporate to really minimize the damage that focal segmental glomerulosclerosis has incurred to those who have APOL1 positivity. But also too, you know, the way I'm utilizing the positive test is now to really educate. And that's kind of one of the things that I've really been focusing on now. Now you have a patient who has some identifiable genetic reason why they have this disease. And by the way, you know, you know, there's been this tremendous misattribution of kidney disease to hypertension. And now what we're finding out is that, you know, that is just not the case.
And even blaming the patient. Oh, you have poor, this Absolutely. Is your fault because of the high blood pressure.
Correct. Right?
And I think a patient's really, it takes the heart, and that's hard on them.
Absolutely. And so that, you know, now they have a peace of mind about that. Now they go in there telling their young kids, you know, they're telling, you know, that, you know, people in their family tree, you know, about the genetic affiliations with kidney disease. You know, I would say overwhelmingly, we're seeing this excitement in the air about this test, and hopefully this trend will just continue to move forward.
Arcana Labs and Vertex Pharmaceuticals are working together to increase awareness of APOL1-mediated kidney disease. And one of the main ways we're going about this is to do just what Dr. Crenshaw spoke about, and that is to decrease barriers to testing. We want more patients to be able to be tested. So specifically, Vertex is sponsoring the testing, so we can offer no-cost APOL1 genotyping, no-cost genetic counseling to those patients who are positive. More people can find out if they have APOL1-mediated kidney disease. It's a test that's a buccal swab that can really easily be performed at a health fair or in a clinician's office or wherever. And then it is shipped back to Arcana, and we re-report the results the next day.
Okay, Chris, now, is it only for patients with proteinuria?
It is any CKD, CKD 1 through 4.
Any CKD. I got a guy who just emigrated from Ireland. He can trace his family back three or four generations in Ireland. He has not a wick of proteinuria, but he's got a GFR of 32. Can I send it for APOL1 testing?
Yeah, so they need to have African ancestry. That's a good point.
They do have to have African ancestry.
They need to self-identify with African ancestry.
I'll tell you a funny story. You know, so yeah. I had a patient who came to me actually just recently, and mind you, you know, she's Caucasian, and we go into this dialogue about the genetic predisposition to kidney disease, and we start talking about APOL1, you know, come to find out she's got, you know, her mother had end-stage renal disease and had a sister that had kidney disease, and we look at her and say, man, you know, you would be APOL1, you know, caliber for testing. And he said, the only caveat is, you know, you're Caucasian. And she says, Dr. Crenshaw, I did one of the ancestry.coms and I had Cameroon in my blood. And I said, wow. So lo and behold, I think we're going to test her. So we'll see how it pans out. But she had Cameroon ancestry in her bloodline. So
yeah.
So we'll see how that pans out.
That's interesting. Well, you know, most people don't really know what their ancestry is in America.
Absolutely.
You know, and we're
all mutts.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, we may think we know sometimes, but we don't always know, you know, what our ancestry is. But yes, the patients do need to self-report African ancestry to be qualified.
Okay. Okay. Hey, thanks, Chris. Daryl, this was awesome. Right, great talking with you.
Nice to meet you too, Joe.
Do not close your browser, especially Brendan, who is only 33% uploaded. Are you hotspotting this on your phone, or are you sending this via Morse code? What's going on, Brendan?
carrier pigeon should be uploaded in carrier pigeon this time.
Okay. Freely Filtered, the irregularly irregular podcast that summarizes and discusses recent NEFJC journal clubs. NEFJC is an online site for post-publication peer review that provides summaries, visual abstracts, interactive chats, newsletters, and podcasts on the research and developments that are driving nephrology forward. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended to give medical advice. If you have questions about your health, this isn't a place to find answers. We suggest talking to your doctor rather than taking the advice of some self-appointed randoms on a podcast. This podcast may discuss off-label and unapproved medications, especially tonight. Hello, my name is Joel Toff, Kidney Boy on Twitter. Tonight we have Swap.
Hey, I'm Swapnil Hiramat. I'm a nephrologist, epidemiologist at the University of Ottawa. I'm on social media at HSwapnil, and I don't have any conflicts today.
Nayan.
Hey, everybody. My name is Nayan Arora. I'm a nephrologist at the University of Washington. I'm at Captain Chloride across a variety of social media platforms. I have no conflicts. My only disclosure is I don't see a lot of glomerular disease, so I'm still using Acthar gel for FSGS, so I'm probably irrelevant here.
Boo!
Oh my goodness.
Priya!
Hey guys, my name is Priya Yenaberry. I'm a transplant nephrologist at Indiana University. My handle is pre-renal AKI, and I have no conflicts of interest.
Excellent. And we have two special guests. Tonight we're going to be talking about the DUPLEX trial, and we have the lead author and good friend of the podcast, Michelle Rowe. Welcome, Michelle.
Hello, I'm Michelle Rowe. I'm a pediatric nephrologist at the University of Minnesota. And my conflict is that I'm the lead author. I was a site PI for the DUPLEX study, and I'm on the steering committee.
Outstanding. I'm not sure if that counts as a conflict or just a disclosure.
That's insight.
Humble brag.
Nothing humble about it. That's great. Congratulations. And we're excited that thank you for coming. And we have Brendan Noon. Brendan, I thought you were in Boston. Why are you in Great Britain now?
I'm in a village in the middle of rural York. My wife's family are over here, so we're over here for Christmas. But it's great to join you guys.
You are truly a citizen of the world.
My name is Brendan Ewan. I'm a nephrologist from Sydney, Australia. I have no specific conflicts of interest. I'm an investigator on the CKD Epi Clinical Trials Consortium, which has done some work validating the GFR slope primary outcome used in the DUPLEX trial. And great to be here today.
So it's what, like 3 o'clock at night, Brendan, there?
2 o'clock in the morning, yeah. I'm going to make myself a coffee, actually. Yeah.
Oh, 2 o'clock.
You get used to doing these kinds of things.
Yeah, that's not the recommended beverage, a freely filtered. Okay, fair enough. We are about to discuss DUPLEX, and we will examine it as we should as a rigorously done randomized controlled trial with active controls. And after all the discussion and hand-wringing, we'll be left with a trial that did not show a difference by the primary endpoint. And it will be easy to wipe our hands of sparsentan and its role in the treatment of FSGS and return to how we treated FSGS prior to October. But take a moment to look at the evidence for the current standard of care. Use of steroids is a 1D recommendations by KDIGO. Quality of evidence section states, a search of the Cochrane Kidney and Transplant Registry of studies identified no randomized controlled trials that evaluated the use of high-dose glucocorticosteroids in adult patients with primary FSGS and nephrotic syndrome. The quality of the evidence is very low, as the evidence that forms the basis of this recommendation is extracted from observational studies in the adult population. The benefits of glucocorticoid use are also extrapolated from pediatric studies in which randomized controlled trials have shown the effectiveness of glucocorticoid treatment in children with nephrotic syndrome, some of whom probably had primary FSGS. Like, this is the landscape that this study lands in. This is a world that it's an absolute evidence desert. And what we're going to be looking at really is an incredibly important trial that shows that even in a rare, poorly defined, quote, syndrome, nephrology is able to organize and pull off a well-done randomized controlled trial, and we can start to build a robust database from which future trials and future patients will benefit.
Yeah, I mean, talking of the lack of evidence, you know, like Nayan's favorite drug here, Acthar, I think the evidence base for Acthar is because ACTH was used, I think, in 1950 before prednisone was even synthesized or available, and it was approved by the FDA for idiopathic edema or whatever, right? So that's how nephrotic syndrome and everything got, that's how it's getting the indication to be used in FSGS. I don't think they even knew that it could be used in FSGS at the time.
Isn't that what we're doing now? We're just repurposing old drugs. You know, acetazolamide made a comeback. Now we got Acthar gel making a comeback. It's nephrology.
Michelle. Yeah,
this is not an old drug. This is a new drug, though. Today we are talking about a new drug. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. So, Michelle, Is this your first lead author study in the New England Journal of Medicine?
Yes, this is my very first lead author study. Never thought I would be there in a million years, but glad I had the opportunity and have learned so much during this process.
I'm still learning. Like how did that happen? I mean, it's awesome and we love it, but like, were you part of this trial group from the very beginning? Were you there when they first started? There was a trial prior to this, the proteinuria trial. What was that called?
The Duet.
Yeah, there was a Duet study. That was the phase two study. It was basically the same as this one, just very much shorter.
And were you a principal investigator in that one also?
I was a site investigator for that study, and then was a site investigator for this study. And then a couple years into this study, probably around 2020, I was asked to serve on the steering committee. They were putting together a steering committee of academic investigators to help guide the study. Vlado Perkovic was the lead of that. So there were a number of people who were put together for that steering committee. We had oversight of this duplex study and then also the PROTECT study of sparsentan in IgA.
Same steering committee was doing both of these.
Worked on both of those. Correct. Yep. Since the studies are very, very similar.
And Vlado was key to your career too, Brendan. Is that right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I spoke about that previously when we did the EmpiKidney podcast. But
I know about it.
Yeah, he's been a tremendous sponsor to many people, and so I'm not surprised. And he's great at giving people opportunities. And you know, Michelle's the perfect person to lead this study. She's done an amazing job. So yeah.
And I think having someone with pediatric expertise is helpful. On the steering committee, I think that was probably something that they were looking for at that time.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it sounds like the trial was already started when you were kind of recruited into this role. Is that right?
That is correct. So the trial was already started. The protocol was all set. So if you ask me detailed questions about why we chose one thing over the other, I may not have the historical insight into that, but
we don't actually go too deep.
Tell you what I know.
We don't go too deep into methods. I wouldn't worry about that. That's not likely to happen.
So, but going back to sparsentan, right? It's like an endothelin antagonist. Going into
and an ARB receptor blocker. Exactly. And an exactly. Estrogen. It's both a floor wax and a non-dairy creamer.
and endothelin, we know about endothelin now for a while. Someone I think has got a Nobel Prize on endothelins and stuff like that. But it's taken a long time for these molecules to come to trials, right? There was nothing. I think one of the first NEFJCs was with atrasentan a long, long time ago. But all of them flopped. But now suddenly in the space of a few months, we are getting this trial after trial with endothelin antagonists. This seems like, you know, the era of endothelin antagonists that we are in now. Going into this trial, did you feel that this was a promising molecule looking at Duet?
Yeah, it seemed like it reduced proteinuria in the Duet study. So it was definitely worth trying. I think knowing the SONAR study results also, I mean, those came out after this study was already underway, but that was also encouraging.
Just for people that don't keep up with NEFJC quite as diligently as you do, the SONAR trial was a diabetic kidney disease with a different endothelin antagonist. That was atrasentan that Swap was talking about. And it showed pretty remarkable results. I mean, not like SGLT2 inhibitor level, but pretty impressive, but with pretty significant side effects. And they did a lot of...
Was SONAR the one or somebody, was that a different one? The one of these trials very carefully selected a group where they made sure they had responders that also didn't have adverse effects just to get
exactly
into the trial.
That's right.
Exactly. Right. They had a run-in phase. They excluded anyone whose weight went up. They excluded anyone with a
heart. Everybody had to be on a diuretic.
And they had to have a proteinuria reduction during the run-in phase, active run-in phase and so on, which is, it's a good trial study design. Despite that, you know, they had benefit, but some harm. And I think the company bailed on atrasentan, but I'm told some other company has maybe now got interested in it. But it didn't go anywhere at the time.
I mean, so many interesting things about sonar, but one of the most important things I think it did was kept the class alive when, like you said, swapped the company, bailed on atrosentan. And those results from sonar, I think, really gave a lot of impetus to all the trials that we're seeing now, testing ERAs in a variety of glomerular diseases. So I think that, plus all of the regulatory environment and the interest and recognition of the importance of doing trials in glomerular diseases, that all kind of has coalesced in the last couple of years that has kept this class going, despite the early pullout in sonar.
Michelle, you may or may not know this because of, I know you came on later. Does the fact that sparsentan got this
breakthrough,
what's it called, you know, orphan drug status from the FDA back in 2015, does that help, you know, does that incentivize these companies to fund these trials because of that designation?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an incentive to move into rare disease. So FSGS, IgA nephropathy, even though, you know, as a pediatric nephrologist, they don't seem like a rare disease to me. They come into my office all the time. But in the grand scheme of things, they're rare disease. So the FDA gives companies, you know, this benefit so that they can recoup some of their costs in the drug development, which is very high.
Yeah, I mean, it is a rare disease, right? If you look at, this is the largest trial and it's just a few hundred patients. You look at, you know, say cardiology trial with 10,000 patients and so on. This is with a lot of effort with so many centers, you know, we got a few hundred trials. So this is definitely a rare disease. But I think this, you know, again, a little bit of a segue, but this whole orphan drug and the FDA accelerated approval, I think that has worked. You know, we can quibble about, you know, what is the outcome? It's not death, it's not dialysis or what have you. But there has been certainly a lot of industry interest in doing trials in nephrology. So from that aspect, I think this is a step in the right direction. You know, even though we may have surrogate outcomes, you know, like what progression-free survival in cancer, you know, we have got proteinuria and GFR slow, but it's a step in the right direction. Companies are doing research, right? At this, at the last kidney week, there were so many new trials. There was so much of, you know, enthusiasm that you could see. There are clinical trials happening. It's not the same old database, USRDS, slicing and dicing that we see otherwise, that we used to see 10 years ago. So there's energy in the air.
And I think the accelerated approval pathway with the FDA now is also something that the companies are using and thinking about as they're bringing these drugs to market as well, something to move things along bit faster.
Excellent.
Yeah. And sparsentan did get it right for the IG. I mean, not for FSGS, but for IgA nephropathy, they got it like about 8-9 mm-hmm. months ago. Yeah. I think Nayan has been meeting their drug reps very regularly.
Just when I'm hungry.
Ready to get started? Let's start tearing this thing apart. Swap, you want to tell us about methods?
If I can. So this is the phase 3 multicenter double blind randomized international trial. They had patients from, you know, North America, South America, Asia, Europe, Australia, you name it. It was really a global trial. In terms of the study population, they included patients from globally. They included patients from 18 to 75. But in the US, they also included patients, you know, Michelle and others enrolled patients who were 8 to 18 years. So it went all the way from 8 years to 75 years. So this is kind of a unique trial where you had pediatric patients as well as adult populations. The inclusion criteria, and this is where I like some help. So yes, they had to have a GFR of more than 30. They had to have proteinuria with a urine protein to creatinine ratio of more than 1.5 gram per gram. But they also needed either biopsy-proven FSGS or some kind of a documented genetic mutation of a podocyte protein associated with FSGS. So what kind of mutation are they talking here?
Yeah, so that was pretty open in the protocol document, but thinking of things like Podocin mutations would be the most common, an INF2 mutation, alpha-actinin 4, some of those types of variants that are known to cause FSGS.
So in case you see someone with nephrotic syndrome, sorry, do you just, you know, screen with these mutations, and if they have this, then you don't bother to biopsy? Is that how it sometimes
works? In pediatrics, no. So if we see someone with nephrotic syndrome, we'll usually treat them with steroids first. If they're steroid resistant, then we will go ahead and do the genetic testing on everybody at that point. And at this point, we're just sending a kind of a big panel of all the genes we can think of that might cause FSGS and test them all at once.
Was APOL1 included in this one?
They did test that. It wasn't an inclusion or exclusion criteria. And that wouldn't have been a genetic variant that we would have just enrolled just based on that.
Got it.
That's covered in table one. It's mentioned.
Exclusion criteria, though, they exclude secondary causes of FSGS. And I guess genetic and APOL1 are not considered secondary causes. Secondary is stuff like, I guess, SLE or diabetes or some virus or drugs or something causing.
Correct. So secondary FSGS, things like single kidney, those types of FSGS overwork kind of issues. The obesity-related FSGS would be secondary. Any other kind of injury type of FSGS would be considered a secondary type, but genetic really considered a separate category. There is quite a bit of controversy over whether genetic FSGS should be considered secondary FSGS and whether those should be lumped together. And I had one or two very prominent nephrologists who will not be named, who cornered me at the meeting and told me what they thought of including genetic FSGS in this category. But that's what we did. And I think it's reasonable to think that those patients may benefit. So why not include them?
I don't know a lot about FSGS, but whether it was genetic or not, I would put them on an ACE inhibitor. Right. And I would put them on an SGLT2 inhibitor. I would use every conservative management to reduce proteinuria. And that's what we're really looking at with this drug. This is another way to reduce proteinuria. Would those physicians who were cornering you at ASN, would they not use an ACE inhibitor in their genetic causes of FSGS? You have to answer for them now, Michelle.
Yeah, it's really, anything you can do to reduce that. I think, having these options that are not immunosuppressive to try is really one of the novel aspects of this drug. Everything else we've used to treat FSGS in the past has been some sort of immunosuppressive agent where, we don't think that those drugs will work for genetic causes.
Isn't this kind of the philosophical question behind all of this? Joel made the comment, he doesn't know much about FSGS, but does anybody know what primary FSGS is? None of this is targeted therapy. We're just trying something and hoping it works.
For the quote FSGS, yeah.
Correct. Right. Yeah, I mean, there's probably five or six different, diseases that are included in this trial. Some of the, circulating factor FSGS, whatever the circulating factor is, there's probably other types of immunologically mediated FSGS that are included as well. And, probably a couple secondary FSGS snuck in because we don't have good biomarkers for what that is. So until we do, we have to design these trials in a way that the practicing physician can use the data to treat their patients. So taking the patients that are in front of them, how can you make your best guess whether they are primary or secondary and will respond to these medications?
Yeah. I mean, we know the circulating factor is not super, but there are many other circulating factors out there, I guess. And now my question though would be different is that why would you even exclude secondary causes? Because this is a non-specific way, right? So it should work whatever be the cause of FSGS. Was there a rationale for that?
I haven't heard the discussion of why that was. My guess would be concerns that the secondary types of FSGS would overrun the primary types, that there would be too many enrolled, and then the primary FSGS would be such a small subset that we wouldn't know if it works in those patients or not.
Right.
So that's what I would guess. From a physiology standpoint, I think it's very reasonable to think that it would work in secondary FSGS as well as any other types. It seems to, be working on some of the final common pathway, kind of CKD progression
right. Sorts
of pathways.
Okay. Cool. So going on with the other exclusions, they had some, standard exclusions, like if someone had liver disease or cancer or heart failure, coronary artery disease, any kind of transplant except cornea transplants, anyone with plans to become pregnant or breastfeeding, which is important because, ARBs, pregnancy doesn't go well. And I think even endothelin antagonists may not go well with pregnancy. So that's a reasonable exclusion. The randomization itself was 1-to-1, but they were stratified.
Call out the wide range in ages, 8 to 75, which is amazing.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, unusual.
8 to 75 outside US and in the US, 8 to 18. Exactly. But this is a disease that occurs in peds. So it's kind of nice, you know, since we are talking about it, is that because if we did not do it, I guess doing a dedicated pediatric trial may never happen. And then so, you know, Michelle and other pediatric nephrologists would be left in an evidence-free zone, which is where most pediatric nephrology people are. So it's nice to have them in, right? Even if it's in a small proportion of patients, so why not?
Yeah, and I think it's really important to include pediatric patients in these groups. There's often arguments to, you know, oh, wait until we have, you know, every last bit of safety data together before we treat a pediatric or adolescent patient with a novel drug. But the pediatric patients are often the ones that need it the most and have the most to potentially benefit from it. When I was at the FDA for a meeting with a different pharmaceutical company for a different drug years ago, they really pushed hard to include pediatric patients in a phase 3 trial because they need to get the data on those patients, and we don't want to exclude them from potential benefit.
Yeah, and then there's a bit of a paternalism, you know, no pun intended, involved here, right? Where you say, oh, we want to, you know, we don't want to hurt the kids, but then you end up with a situation where you have to use drugs off-label and or there is no indication, right? Because they have never been used and never been tested in that population. So kudos to the investigators for doing that. So back to intervention before Joel interrupted me. So one-to-one randomization, but it was stratified for two things. One was the GFR, less than 30 to 60 or more than 60 was one stratification. The other one was proteinuria. So for adults, proteinuria more than or less than 3.5 grams. And for peds, proteinuria more than or less than 2 gram, or UPCR more than or less than 2 gram per gram. So those were two stratifications. So we'll, you know, those will be interesting to look at in the subgroup analysis later. So patients may, so as far as the intervention is concerned, patients who were already on RAS inhibition, they had a washout of 2 weeks because they were now going to get randomized to either irbesartan or sparsentan. And then during the, there was a run-in, no, there was a washout period, no run-in period. And then they were randomized to getting double-blind either sparsentan or irbesartan. I guess they were started on 150 of irbesartan, then was ramped up to 300. And for sparsentan, similarly, the target dose was 800 milligram. And I think they were followed up. If they didn't have hypotension or orthostatic dizziness, then, you know, it would be titrated up to 800 milligram. And we'll see in the results how many went on whichever dose.
And this is double
the duration of the trial.
This is double the dose that we used in the IgA trial, right?
Exactly. In PROTECT, it was 400 milligram. Here it was
any
milligram. And Michelle, is this
any thoughts on that, Michelle?
You think you need a bigger?
Yeah, so sparsentan's a highly protein bound drug. So the choice of the higher dose in the FSGS study was designed to ensure adequate tissue exposure in patients who have a lot of proteinuria and low serum albumin.
Proteinuria.
So in patients who have a lot of proteinuria, they may need a higher dose to achieve those same tissue levels.
And you, since you were part of both these trials, could you see differences in adverse events or in other changes between these two doses? Did you get a sense that there was a dose response?
You know, the adverse events from the PROTECT and the DUPLEX study seemed to be pretty similar. There weren't significantly more adverse events with the 800 milligram dose compared to the lower dose in the IgA study.
So the duration of the study was 2 years, 108 weeks. And then there were another 4 weeks where the sparsentan or irbesartan was stopped, and they went on to standard of care treatment, including RAS inhibition, for the last 4 weeks. So there are going to be measurements done at baseline at 108 weeks and at 112 weeks, which will be important when we come to the outcomes. So the primary efficacy endpoint in the US was total GFR slope. And I think outside the US, it was the chronic slope. And I think
this why was it different?
It would be nice if all of the regulatory agencies could get together and agree upon an endpoint. But up until now, they have not. So the US FDA requires total slope for their studies. And the EMA and other regulatory bodies use chronic slope, or that 6 to 108 weeks.
Yeah, so we'll ask Brendan mm-hmm. to talk a little bit more about this. But, you know, for listeners who may not know about this, we'll put a graph in the show notes. I think the graph that, you know, Brendan has tweeted about or written about is very useful, is that with especially with RAS inhibition, there is an acute drop you know, the immediate, everyone knows of this, right? Or even with Flozins, we see that with RAS inhibition, we see that, and we see that with sparsentan and a few other drugs, is that once you start this drug, there is a small, there is a bump in creatinine, a small drop in GFR. That's the acute slope. And then there is the longer term slope, that is the chronic slope. And the total slope includes the acute slope and the chronic slope. And I would have thought, right, especially I think Renal was the first study that showed this, was that, you know, ignore the acute slope. Who cares about it, right? It's the chronic slope that matters. Is that that was my feeling, that the chronic slope is what would matter, right? That's the longer term thing. But I think there was a systematic review that Brendan was a part of, which seemed to suggest that total slope matters more. And that's why the FDA has taken that as the outcome. Am I right, Brendan?
Yeah, that's right, Swapnil. No, when you look at all of the available data from CKD trials, I mean, the big question is, with an intermediate or surrogate endpoint, you want an endpoint that captures the treatment effect on kidney failure the best. So what we've done in the consortium is look at all of the clinical trials in CKD and look at randomized treatment effects on different surrogate endpoints and treatment effects on kidney failure and see which of those line up best. And interestingly, when you now look at all of the available data, total slope, which includes the acute effect, seems to correlate more strongly with the treatment effect on kidney failure than treatment effects on chronic slope. Why that is, I don't think anyone knows for certain, but that has probably been some of the rationale for using total slope by the US regulatory agencies compared to the other places around the world that are willing to accept chronic slope. This is an evolving area, and we're going to see a lot more discussion about it moving forward.
But right now, the data supports the FDA and looking at total slope.
I think Julie's asking that the data does support what the FDA is deciding, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, the strongest evidence is for total slope, using total slope, so not excluding the acute effect. The data show that treatment effects on total slope correlate very strongly with treatment effects on the clinical outcome of doubling of serum creatinine or kidney failure over a period of 3 years. Now, all of these GN trials are typically 2-year studies. And so the data are a little bit less strong for 2-year slope. And I think we can talk about this later on, but, is 2 years long enough to reliably detect a treatment effect on kidney disease progression? I'm not sure whether it is, but the best data are for 3-year total slope. And then after that, probably total slope over 2 years and chronic slope a little bit less robust. But, you know, it's very, all of these treatments that we have, SGLT2 inhibitors, Flozins, MRAs, RAS inhibitors, they all cause acute effects. And to overcome that acute effect in a 2-year period is very difficult. So that's the challenge with a 2-year study.
It just seems like then study duration becomes even more important when considering these. I mean, was it EMPA-KIDNEY, the curves didn't even cross over till 18 months. And we're talking about, if we had stopped at 2 years,
exactly, yeah,
you know, you kind of lose that whole acute slope period.
Yeah,
exactly. And for listeners, you know, if you step back until maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, the outcome that was accepted by the FDA was doubling of creatinine and kidney failure. I think one of the first trials where GFR slope was used was REPRISE. I got this wrong at the live taping where Josh mentioned that. And I said, no, Josh was right. So REPRISE was the first trial where GFR slope was accepted as an outcome. And that was because it was PKD, ADPKD, in which the progression is so slow that the concern is you will not have enough kidney failure outcomes. So as an exception, the FDA at that time said, okay, they tried to sell total kidney volume. The FDA didn't buy that, but they did buy GFR slope, saying, okay, GFR does matter for kidneys. So we'll accept it. And then these studies came along, right? The ones, the data that Brendan is talking about was published in Nature Medicine. And we'll put the link in the show notes. But these CKD trials, what they've done is they've collected all the large trials. I guess they're mostly diabetic nephropathy trials, right, Brendan? Maybe a few other trials. And those are the trials that are supporting the use of GFR slope.
Yeah, a mixture of general CKD diabetes and GN trials with one or two cardiovascular trials. But, you know, I like your point, sort of, that like if you take a historical perspective, go a couple of years back and regulatory agencies were only accepting doubling of serum creatinine, which is a really high bar for a kidney disease progression trial. And it means that trials were restricted to people with very advanced disease, very fast progressors. And there was not a lot of incentive to really robustly study glomerular diseases. And you have a situation in the last five or so years where we've got really great epidemiological evidence of the relationship between GFR slope and kidney failure. We've got really good randomized evidence of that treatment effects on GFR slope correlate with treatment effects on kidney failure. And that's given everyone really clear goalposts about what we can do in clinical trials, in the trials landscape, and it's given people confidence to invest in the area. And that's why we're seeing all of these trials in GNs now, because we've got good epidemiological evidence, good trial evidence, and good agreement from regulators. And that's the environment or context in which trials like Duplex are now possible. And that's really exciting.
Does anyone here have insight then into why European or other agencies disagree with the FDA on their determination? I mean, they have access to the same data. Why do they have a difference of opinion?
I think it reflects that uncertainty with the relationship between chronic slope and the outcome versus total slope in the outcome. I think if you're going to be most conservative, I think the data suggests that total slope is more reliable than chronic slope, which excludes the acute effect. But over 2 years, there is a rationale for excluding the acute effect because it's just so hard to show an effect on total slope when you have a therapy that reduces GFR initially. Like with sparsentan and other drugs.
And as Brendan was saying, the acceptance of slope as a surrogate outcome really allows companies to move into rare disease. So you can do slope GFR studies with 300, 400 patients, whereas if you're looking at that doubling of serum creatinine and end-stage kidney disease, you're going to need thousands of patients. So it does allow you to move into rare disease, some of the GNs, a little bit just easier than you would otherwise.
Interesting.
Yeah, the FSGS trial would never happen if it was doubling of creatinine.
Well, or a slow going disease like autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease.
Alport syndrome, for example.
Or the non-diabetics, non-proteinuria that we saw in Evenbuck kidney.
Yeah.
Had a subgroup that had very low progression because they didn't have proteinuria and they didn't have diabetes. And
in that subgroup, the GFR slope analysis is the one that we talked about more than the, because there were very few ESKD outcomes in that subgroup. Can I keep going on the
please.
Endpoints? Yeah. Yeah, I know we are just almost an hour in. But they also looked at the 112 weeks, the 4 weeks after stopping sparsentan and what happens, right? We saw that was also done with tolvaptan in the reprise to take out the acute slope effect is that you stop the drug.
Or the hemodynamic
see what
effect.
Happens to the GFR. Exactly. The hemodynamic effect is gone. So that was also another outcome that they report that we'll go back to the results. That's not the baseline to 108 weeks, it's the baseline to 112-week outcome. Apart from that, you know, the other outcomes were changes in GFR, changes in proteinuria, partial remission, complete remission. So, and you know, all different ways of slicing and dicing the endpoints, looking at proteinuria, kidney failure. There were safety outcomes because endothelin antagonists do have safety concerns. For the analysis, so this is where the things get tricky, is that the assumption was that they would be looking at a 2.5 ml per minute per 1.73 meter square difference in GFR slope. So that's a pretty clinically important GFR signal difference, right? Over 2 years, it'll be a 5 ml per minute per 1.73 meter square surface area difference.
What's the minimum that the FDA accepts as significant between groups?
If you look at the epidemiological data, treatment effects of greater than 0.75 mils per minute per year almost always predict a treatment benefit on a clinical outcome. So it doesn't sound like a lot, 0.75 mils per minute per year, but we're talking about mean differences. Within that, there'll be fast progressors, slow progressors, but the data suggests that in a reasonable size trial, that a treatment effect of greater than 0.75 mils per minute per year is usually predictive in most cases of a treatment benefit on the clinical outcome.
So I guess if the 0.75 would have been used, you would have needed a much bigger sample size, perhaps. That's one. And The second thing, I guess the reason was that in the 8-week DUET trial, they saw that, the difference in partial remission was 20% versus 50%. And they sort of extrapolated on the basis of that, saying, hey, if we see such a big dramatic difference in partial remission, then this is the kind of GFR difference that we might expect to see, is why 2.5 was chosen, which is sort of the key element we'll come to in the results.
What we know about proteinuria and progression in FSGS is patients that do better, with the therapies that we have do better, right? Patients that get reduction in proteinuria have reduced outcomes, but it's just it's hard to, since it's all just observational data, it's hard to separate out just patients with less severe disease. They're going to get less proteinuria and they're going to have less progression, whether it really is the lower proteinuria that's driving it. It just kind of shows you the kind of quicksand that they were trying to build the foundation on. It just was not, they didn't have robust data to make these kind of guesses.
And I think we're just at the beginning of that with FSGS. We're having more studies where there's an intervention with a reduction in proteinuria and outcome data, where we're going to be able to start to pool some of these together and really learn a lot more about, how much is the benefit of reducing proteinuria by 50% or by 25%.
Exactly. So the GFR slope itself, in again, just because we have pediatric populations here, in adults, it was done with CKD epi, and in kids, they used a different formula, the modified Schwartz formula for those who were less than 16 years of age. And I guess that's the formula that is preferred in pediatric populations. The analysis itself is pretty straightforward, so I wouldn't go into that. I bored people enough with that discussion of methods that I didn't have any concerns with the analytic plans itself.
I think we should call out that instead of just looking at proteinuria as a continuous variable, they did the dichotomization thing, and we said we'll talk about partial remission and complete remission with specific steps to achieve that, which seemed, Engel. What's the woman's name who's the editor of the NEJM?
Julie Engelfinger.
She points out that those are not evidence-based definitions, partial remission and complete remission. They're kind of convention. We've defined them by convention. And
so I'll push back a little bit on please. The partial remission data. So the definition of partial remission that was used in this study was protein to creatinine ratio of less than 1.5 and a greater than 40% reduction. And there was a publication from 2018 from Jonathan Troost and C. Jason, where they looked at various definitions of partial remission in patients with FSGS. And that definition correlated with kind of hard kidney outcomes. So that definition is what was used in this study, because that FSGS partial remission endpoint does correlate with the hard kidney outcomes of doubling of serum creatinine.
Okay.
And that was sort of the, was that the one which was also the interim efficacy?
Correct. Yeah.
You know, at 36 weeks, they looked at this. As
correct.
So was the hope there that they would look at it, and if it was significant, they would go for an accelerated approval or something like that? Or it was just something they...
I think looking at to see if they should continue on with the study. Many studies often have that look, kind of look in point. To see if it's worth moving on. If you would have looked at 36 weeks and there was absolutely no difference between the two groups and in partial remission, then it's not worth going for 5 more years.
The last part is that this was, of course, funded by Travere, the maker of sparsentan, and they funded the study. I think they had some independent vendor analyze the study, and you and the senior author, the last author, they wrote the most of the manuscript. How was that experience? Whatever you can share.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good experience. It's nice to have somebody helping you with the language in that way. So I think that was helpful to have somebody who had written for something like New England Journal before and knows what kind of structure that they're looking for. So that was helpful for me, since I had never done anything from that way. But they were very good about, really letting the steering committee and the senior authors really shape the message that we wanted to get across.
Yeah. One interesting thing I found about the study was the washout period before randomization. Most CKD trials have a period of up titration of RAS inhibitor or, single blind run-in before the trial gets going with randomization. What was the decision behind using a washout period, stopping everyone's ARB and then re-randomizing them? Was there a discussion about up titrating everyone's RAS inhibitor and then randomizing them to staying on that drug or switching to an ERA?
Yeah, I think that the decision about the washout period was we needed to keep the angiotensin receptor blocker blinded during the study. So if you would have up titrated their dose and then kept them on it, you would only be able to keep them on it as a control arm. And then if they were randomized to sparsentan, they would have to stop that. So it really puts everybody at an even starting point.
Sounds good.
Well, the only thing that at the very end of the study, and this is like, week 108, everybody gets stopped off the study drug, right? And then what's the RAS inhibition at that point? They go back to their pre?
Yeah, so
that's my understanding.
Yep, there were no specific instructions for what to do with the RAS inhibitor other than to resume standard of care. So if the patient before entering the study was on, irbesartan 150, they would go ahead and go back on that dose or whatever drug they happened to be on prior to the study.
Gotcha.
But no sparsentan, right? So
correct.
Some RAS inhibitor, some ARB or possibly nothing.
Correct.
Can I ask you something else, which I didn't talk about, but I didn't see immunosuppression in the inclusion or exclusion criteria. But patients could be on immunosuppression, right? That was a subgroup that you mentioned during the results later on. How was that handled?
Yeah, so about 25% of patients were on immunosuppression at the entry of the study. So they were either on, and there were rules about how long their steroid dose had to be stable before they entered the study or how long their CNI dose had to be stable. I don't remember exactly the amounts, but to enter the study, you had to be on stable immunosuppression. In a perfect world, you would stay on that dose throughout the whole study. But we all know in dealing with these patients, sometimes you just have to hit them with more steroids or you have to give them a higher calcineurin dose or you have to adjust the dose to keep their levels where you need them to be. So there was some up and down of the immunosuppression for those patients. But one thing that we haven't looked at yet is, for patients who are on sparsentan, were they able to come off of their steroids? Were they able to wean down some of their immunosuppression? And I think that's going to be a really interesting analysis when we get to it too. It's only 25% of the group, but we may see some differences there.
And I think it's important that we actually get to the results because I think there's some interesting things about that. That's one of the things that they call up. But Swap has one more thing. What do you got, Swap? What's your one last thing?
Yeah. No, this is important because let's say in the irbesartan group, it's possible that someone's CNI gets increased and their proteinuria goes down because of the CNI and not because of irbesartan. Like we face this in the renal denervation trials, right? Where people titrate the blood pressure drugs outside the intervention and that makes a difference into how you analyze the outcome. So this is something we should look at in the results. Results. Over to you, Priya.
That's what I was saying. We should talk about results. Priya, do you have any results? Right.
Should we talk about results then? There were 724 patients that were screened and ultimately 371 were randomized. 184 were in the sparsentan arm and then 187 in the irbesartan arm. Looking at the characteristics between the two patient groups, they're fairly similar. Mean age was about 41 and a half between both arms. We do have pediatric population as well. That turned out to be about 9% in both of the groups were less than 18 years old. Female participation between the two groups, 46%. Mean eGFR between both of the groups were 64. And the median urine protein to creatinine ratio was 3. About 80% of all the patients were on some type of RAS inhibition prior to the washout period. And of course, that was stopped. In regards to the immunosuppressive meds, which we chatted about just briefly, about 7% in each arm were on some type of immunosuppressive medication, either at the start of the trial or continued during the start of the trial.
So that table one, Nyan, has the high-risk APOL1 variants, and it was 5% in the sparsentan group and 3% in the irbesartan. So significantly more.
You wanted me to read the paper before the podcast?
That's what I was just telling you. No, I don't want. I don't expect you to do any kind of homework. Come on now. But essentially, they had twice as many people with the high-risk variants than the inaxaplin paper had. It's twice the N. And then they used here in this study that the inaxaplin paper didn't use. It's called a control group. It was pretty fascinating stuff. I'm telling you, this stuff is cutting edge.
In my defense for homework, I did Google what FSGS stood for before.
That's why we have them on the podcast, ladies and gentlemen.
Small steps.
Really, just impeccable background work. The other thing I found interesting.
Though you don't know how to treat it still.
Nobody does. It's fine. He's a lot of company.
He told us.
What a lunch they had. What a lunch.
You mentioned this already.
No, the other thing I thought was interesting was time from FSGS diagnosis to enrollment was years. 2 years was the median time for the sparsentan group and 3 years for the irbesartan group. Like, these people were not fresh diagnoses. They probably had gone through some primary therapy before they got here. You know, and I just go on. Tell me, Michelle.
Say that speaks to our kind of clinical journey in treating these patients. So the patients who first comes to your door with FSGS, you're going to treat them with steroids. That's going to take you 3 to 6 months. You're probably going to do some genetic testing. That's going to take you a while. You probably have them on a calcineurin inhibitor at that time. And then it's really, you know, many of our patients will respond to a calcineurin inhibitor, at least in pediatrics, and they'll either go into a complete remission or pretty darn close. And then we just kind of want to watch them really closely, and we're not going to enroll those patients into a clinical trial. But it's the patients who we've treated with everything we can think of, and they haven't gone into remission or still have severe proteinuria. Those are the ones that we're going to want to enroll
into
a clinical trial.
This is a population that is selected for bad actors. Right. These are people
Correct.
That have been treated presumably for a couple of years. And now
that may bias our results
and still have significant proteinuria. Minimum was 1.5 grams. Is that right? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
So, yeah.
Yeah. The median was much higher than 1.5. Yeah.
It's probably in table one.
Three.
Yeah, it was about three.
About 3 grams.
Yeah, about
3 grams. Right, and then a third of them were the worst actors, which was the patients with nephrotic syndrome, right? Because the FSGS but no nephrotic syndrome, those ones are a little squirrely. They're a little bit – it's not clear that they get a benefit from treatment. Those are the tough one, the tough call. I have a number of those patients in my clinic. Biopsy shows FSGS, but they don't have nephrotic syndrome. The proteinuria is not that bad. I always hesitate to expose them to high dose steroids, but sparsentan would be enough.
Have you heard of Acthar Gel?
No, please
no,
tell
don't.
Us about it.
Please don't. Oh my God.
Please, please. I still don't know when to use it. Clearly enough.
Never.
FSGS.
Never.
Yeah, never is the right answer.
Proper answer. Oh my God. That was...
Despite the number of lunches you may have had.
Yep.
Okay.
So that was essentially the basics of baseline characteristics between the two groups. I think we hit the big points there. So we'll kind of talk about the primary endpoint and then the big guns, which is the proteinuria, which we'll probably discuss a little bit more on. So remember, the primary endpoint for this is that eGFR slope, the total, and then the chronic. So we'll talk about the total slope first. This will be day 1 to week 108. There was no significant change between the two groups when it came to the eGFR slope. In the sparsentan group, it was about 5.4 milliliters per minute per year. And then the irbesartan group was about 5.7. So at the end of the day, a p-value of 0.75, which again wasn't really what we were expecting, but we have some good stuff with proteinuria later. When we look at the chronic slope,
I think it's just important just to look at how fast the loss of kidney function is in this group, regardless of which. I mean, 5 cc's a year, that's bad. That's mm-hmm. that's like diabetic nephropathy without ACE inhibitors bad? Brendan, any comment?
Nothing
there?
More to add, Joel. I mean, it's as you've outlined, a super high risk population, and yep. that's reflected in the rate of GFR decline in the control arm. Just high, underscores how difficult this population is to treat. So yeah.
Okay, Priya, sorry about that.
Yeah, and if you look in the because if you look in the chronic slope, it kind of piggybacks with that. The irbesartan group shows about the same exact GFR decline of 5.7, and the sparsentan group about 4.8. So at the end of the day, it seems like that first 4 weeks that we talked about, total slope versus chronic slope, is where a lot of the decline happens. And then if you go out even further, the mean eGFR from day one to 112 weeks, which would be 4 weeks after the drug was stopped, the sparsentan group had negative 10.4 mils per year, if you will, and 12.1 in the irbesartan group.
I'm assuming that's total, right?
That's total, correct, not per year. That 10.4 is the two-year total.
You also looked at the total slope and the chronic slope defined in different ways. I think that's figure S7 in the supplement, Joel. I know you have read the supplement very clearly, but I know Michelle showed this during her presentation. And one of these, you know, again, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So there are 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. So there are 16 ways of looking at this data. And one of them is significant, which is the chronic slope if you exclude the people who had immunosuppression, which is what we were talking about, the methods.
Yeah, so it excludes patients who either have new immunosuppression started or have their immunosuppression dose increased. If they all stayed the same, then they're still included.
And in that group, it looks like sparsentan is superior.
Correct. It was barely significant for the chronic slope when you exclude those patients who have immunosuppression added.
So again, because we are looking at 15, 16 ways of doing this, this may be chance, but arguably this could also be what we were talking about, is that, you know, it's kind of a more pure subgroup of patients in whom there's nothing else confounding. There's no CNI adjustment or steroid or whatever.
Correct.
Playing.
But the number of patients that had this done to them, that had their immunosuppression increased or started, was the same in both groups. It wasn't a situation where reducing the proteinuria with the sparsentan made them less likely to get immunosuppression, which is something that intuitively makes sense, but that is not how it turned out in the study. Those groups were balanced.
That's correct. There were about the same numbers in each group that had immunosuppression started or increased.
I think if there was an imbalance in immunosuppression initiation in the trial between the two treatment arms, I think that would lend more credence to that result that you're talking about, swap of the significance when you censor people at initiation or intensification of immunosuppression. But with the because those are balanced between the treatment arms, I think, you know, it's one. Exploratory analyses of about 12 different analyses, so lends less credence to it, I think.
Yeah, that was a well-written article that you guys addressed that right in the results section. 16.3% in the sparsentan group versus 16% in the irbesartan group. 30 patients in each group.
Yeah, proteinuria.
So yeah, moving on to proteinuria, it was shown that there was a greater reduction in the sparsentan group compared to the irbesartan. We're looking at figure 1B right now. At 108 weeks, there was partial remission in proteinuria. That was 38% in the sparsentan group and 23% in the irbesartan group. And the median time it took to achieve that partial remission was 14 weeks in the sparsentan group and 109 weeks in the irbesartan group. So quite a bit of a difference in terms of the timing, if you will.
Michelle, are you surprised by the response to irbesartan alone? I mean, this is it's a high-risk population. 80% were on ACE or ARBs before this. Despite that, they had 3 grams of proteinuria, but you're seeing a pretty substantial reduction. And I don't know if this percentage of
partial and complete remission is what you expected, or more?
Yeah, you know, I'm not surprised by the 30% reduction in proteinuria. That seems reasonable and kind of what I see clinically. I'm a little bit surprised by the partial and complete remission, that the number of, you know, even, you know, that any patients go into a complete remission. But I think it goes to the heterogeneity of the FSGS population that we have included. You know, it's a relapsing disease, and some people go into spontaneous remissions, and we sometimes pat ourselves on the back and we think that we did it, and maybe we did not.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's also interesting that the way you guys measured the proteinuria, they did, it was three first morning urines in 5 days. And I look forward Correct. To seeing that future publication about what was the variability among those three different PCRs that they averaged. I think it was they took an average of that.
Correct. Yeah.
It was a morning also. It was not a random anytime during the day. It's a morning urine PCR. And the reason, of course, you know, like GN people talk about 24-hour urine all the time, but that's a pain, and it's often inaccurate because of undercollections, overcorrections. So, you know, the first morning urine PCR has the strongest correlation, but it's even better if you repeat it, right, rather than just do it once. So, I agree. I look forward to some more publication of how that did vary.
I think the data from this study could keep my career going for another 10, 15 years, maybe.
As it should. Yeah, milk this for everything. That's how the greats did it.
So I know that we just chatted about the UPCR at the end of it at 108 weeks, but I did want to mention what we saw at 36 weeks, which was one of the numbers that jumped out at me, was for this partial remission at 36 weeks, 44% of the sparsentan group saw this partial remission and 23% in the irbesartan group. And that turned out to be statistically significant in terms of looking at the UPCRs and our proteinuria in terms of secondary analyses.
Okay. Yeah. Now this is I got to ask this question. So in terms of this efficacy, they first said that the estimated percentage of patients who had partial remission of proteinuria was 42 versus 26. What is this estimated?
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because I have these two sets of numbers. One's estimated and one's actually observed. Where would we have gotten, you know, one set versus the other?
The estimated numbers come from a subset of patients who completed the trial first. So from that initial group. And then I believe it's extrapolated out. And then you show what you actually.
Yeah, but the observed number only has an N of 88 and 82. The observed number is the smaller number. It looks like not everybody had that 36-week visit.
That's a good question. I don't have an answer
Excellent.
For that.
And that's my only goal. Okay. Weird, but the numbers aren't that so different. Whatever. They got better proteinuria reduction with sparsentan, but not as good as they expected, right?
Correct. Yeah. Based on the Duet study, the assumptions going in were that there would be a 50% partial remission for patients treated with sparsentan and 20% with irbesartan. So irbesartan did a little bit better, sparsentan did a little bit worse, and that's probably one of the reasons that we didn't reach significance with the slope.
Darn. Okay.
Now moving on to complete remission, and this is anything less than 0.5, I believe. 19% received complete remission in the sparsentan arm and 8% in the irbesartan arm. And interestingly, what we see after is 85% of the group maintained remission in the sparsentan arm. At 29 weeks, they continued to have maintained this remission compared to 18 weeks in the irbesartan arm where they maintained remission. So not almost twice as much, but definitely at least 10 weeks longer in the sparsentan arm compared to the irbesartan arm, which is, that sounds great to me. Yeah.
Yeah, they have the Kaplan-Meier curves for that in the supplement figure S5, time to partial and complete remission.
Correct. So with sparsentan, you go into remission earlier and then you sustain that remission longer in general.
Anything else with the proteinurias?
Yeah, I just think the thing that was, I thought, not well verbalized or written in the document was that they could go into partial remission and they could fall out of it the next month, but you were counting time to they first getting partial remission. And I didn't get a sense of the cumulative percentage of people that were in these remissions throughout the study. I thought that might have been an interesting thing to show.
Yeah, and I think that will come out in some of the subsequent manuscripts, you know, an area under the curve, if you will, how many people remain in remission during the study.
So we're still pretty early when it comes to picking apart all this data then. So
and some of what we're limited to is how the, you know, how the protocol is written. You know, at the beginning of the study, you write down what your primary, secondary outcomes are going to be. And then when you go ask New England Journal to publish that, that's all they want to see. You cannot show them any of the kind of random stuff you think of later, because that's not what you said you were going to do. So all of that stuff has to come later.
And all that stuff is much more interesting when the primary outcome is less significant, right? Like, right, you know, all your hopes and dreams are crushed. You'll start to look for other things. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And then finishing up with the composite kidney outcomes. So we're essentially looking at three things, and I'll kind of lay them out for you here. Number one, reduction in the eGFR of at least 40%. Number two, kidney failure, or number three, death, of course. In the sparsentan group, that's 20%, and the irbesartan group, 23%. Another composite was a decrease in the eGFR of at least 50%. And then the same two endpoints, kidney failure or death, it was 11% in the sparsentan group and 16% in the irbesartan group. And then finally, just kidney failure in general, its own outcome itself, sparsentan 7% and irbesartan 11%.
But if you look at the absolute numbers here in the figure 2, Priya talked about the percentages. If you look at the absolute numbers, there were 10 people who did not develop kidney failure. And it looks like there were 9 people. And it looks like there were 10 people who did not have the 50% reduction in GFR outcome. So it's like, you know, 10 people were saved in the 50% as well as the kidney failure. And maybe 7 when it comes to 40% reduction in GFR. So here's my question for everyone, but Brendan in particular. When we move towards this softer endpoints, you know, say 40% GFR instead of kidney failure and doubling of creatinine, you get more events. So because you get more events, it's easier to do trials and say, hey, you know, yeah, you got a lot of events and, you know, your trial ended rather than having, you know, very few events. But to me, it looks like a much more noisy outcome. Here, the difference in the 40% is like 7. And the relative risk is 0.87. Whereas if you look at the, you know, the pure kidney failure, the difference is 10 or a 9, sorry. You know, it's even greater than the 40% in absolute events. And the relative risk is 0.58, which looks way more impressive. So are you sort of getting more events but losing something by getting more noisy events with the software endpoint?
Yeah, I think, you know, this question of should we use 40% or should we use 50% rather than doubling is a really important one. The times I think that you're absolutely right that if you use a less stringent threshold, you're going to get more events and potentially more study power. But the situations where you're going to dilute your potential treatment effect are if you have one, a large acute effect, so a large eGFR dip. Two, if your rate of progression is slow. And three is depending on what the treatment effect of the drug you're actually studying is. And I think in this a situation like Duplex, where you've got a very fast rate of progression in the background, that should overcome the acute effect. And so I'm less concerned about the 40 versus 50% in situations like Duplex, where you have such a fast rate of progression. I'm a little bit more concerned in like normal albuminuric or slow progressors, because that acute effect can muddy the treatment effect on 40% decline. And if you look at, so if you go back to SONAR, which is atrasentan, another ERA, and look at different GFR thresholds, 40, 50, 57%, it generally comes out in the wash. So my personal opinion on Duplex and this difference, or, you know, supposed difference between 40 and 50% is it's probably just a bit of noise, a bit of the play of the chance. I don't think it reflects any different, I don't think it matters in the end.
Okay, I'm reading too much into the small numbers.
There's a temptation to do that. I
that was my first instinct as well. So no, but I think the rate of progression is so fast, it doesn't matter. When the rate of progression is slow, I think that's when I get a bit worried that you're diluting the treatment effect with 40% rather than 50%.
Back to you, Priya.
Okay, so we'll now move on to just the safety profiles of each of these groups here. When it comes to at least one adverse event in each arm, it was about the same, 94%, 93%. The most common seemed to be peripheral edema or COVID, essentially. Regarding serious adverse events, we're looking at supplemental table 3, showed to be about 37% in the sparsentan group and 44% in the irbesartan. But when it comes to discontinuation of the meds, that was about the same in each, 14% in the sparsentan group and 12% in the irbesartan group. And these could be anywhere from UTIs, pneumonias, hypotension, all these things in the supplements, kind of looking at those.
One thing that struck me was that the hypotension was a little bit more with sparsentan, like 18 versus 11,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting because, but the blood pressure was not different. Figure S8 has the blood pressures, and the blood pressures were, the mean blood pressures were very similar, but sparsentan did have more hypotension. Again, I thought, you know, it would be like the, you know, Flozins also reduce blood pressure a little bit and reduce proteinuria. ACE inhibitors reduce blood pressure, reduce proteinuria. Sparsentan doesn't seem to reduce blood pressure so much, maybe a little bit, but it does seem to reduce proteinuria a little bit more than just ARB alone. Is that sort of in your hands? Did you see a blood pressure effect or did you notice anything?
Yeah, I think, you know, it certainly reduces blood pressure as much as the angiotensin receptor blockers do. So the, you know, the patients who are on maximum ARBs and on the and sparsentan had pretty similar blood pressure reduction in the study. So there didn't seem to be much of a difference there.
The safety profile is remarkable. After seeing the previous endothelin antagonists, I was so prone to look for that heart failure and the peripheral edema and the fluid overload, and not seeing any of those signals emerge, it really is impressive. This drug is a lot safer than the endothelin antagonists that we have seen in trials before.
It's really encouraging that we didn't see that. And I think for patients who are on the drug who have to, you know, of course, it's not approved for FSGS, it's approved for IgA, but the duplex open label extension study is closed now. So it's all those patients are being stopped on drug and are needing to roll on to commercially available sparsentan. So to do that, they have to enter the REMS program. So they have to get labs drawn every month, whereas in the study, they were only getting labs drawn every 3 months. So it's so hard for these patients to do that. But, you know, that's what the FDA says they have to do.
How long did the open label last? Sorry, Nan. How long did the open label extension last? This was like everyone got sparsentan for a year or
Everyone got sparsentan up until now. So dependent on when they finished. I had the longest patient in the open label extension, and he had a total of 9 years on study.
Oh wow!
Wow.
So for some patients, there's potential pretty long follow ups. Sorry, I'm going to take a step back and correct myself. I said that the duplex open label extension is closed. It's the duet open label extension that's closed. The duplex open label is still ongoing.
Good.
We mentioned the safety profile is much better with this study, particularly with the peripheral edema, which was rampant with the other studies and actually caused them to stop early. Is that patient selection, or are there actual differences within drugs of the same class, or a combination of both?
I think that's a good question. You know, the FSGS population overall is a relatively young population. So they may not have the heart disease that you would see in the diabetic kidney disease studies. So you may not see some of the fluid retention from that standpoint.
And I think this is going to be really important because, I mean, this is a ARB plus ETA, endothelin A antagonist. I think there are some which are dual endothelin antagonists, and I don't know if that matters. You know, so there's atrasentan, there's zibotentan, there's sparsentan, there is aprocitentan in hypertension. So It's going to be interesting to see if all these drugs are interchangeable, like, you know, flozins or ACE inhibitors, or are they like beta blockers where, you know, one will be different than the other, which will be interesting to see, especially because the cost may be different for many of these drugs going forward.
I think mechanistically, receptor ETB is more responsible for naturesis and diuresis. So, you know, who knows? Maybe it matters, mm-hmm. maybe it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. And on this point, when this trial was started, there were no flozins.
I was just going to say, just anecdotally, I have two patients that were in the DUET trial pulled out. I put them on SGLT2 inhibitors and they're, you know, doing remarkably well. It's just interesting to see. Obviously, that's an anecdotal N of two, but it's hard to argue against.
Yeah, you didn't give them Actar.
They couldn't afford it. You know, so
there it is.
Have you explored our patient assistance programs?
but that is, I mean, I hate to say it, but this is an expensive drug, right? If you go for 800 milligrams, it's going to be like $20,000, the official price, right? I'm sure it'll come down. It's like $20,000 a month. And even if there is a benefit in proteinuria and complete remission, it's like, you know, you're using $500,000 a year for some proteinuria reduction and possibly maybe a little bit of GFR slope difference. It's a hard sell.
That it is. Are we done with the results?
Yeah, we talked about the fluid retention already. Other things, pretty much were very well balanced between the two. AKI was one of the things that I scribbled down because nephrology. So, well, it's important, right? So,
yeah. We're all interested in that.
Pre-renal AKI.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's your Twitter handle.
It's the one thing I got to talk about. But really between the two, very, very, very similar in terms of their AKI rates. Regarding patient death, of course, just kind of rounding it out. In the sparsentan group, 4 patients, which came out to be about 2%, and 3 patients in the irbesartan group, about 1.5% in terms of mortality there. Regarding the trial drugs, there were no deaths in the irbesartan group that was thought to be due to a trial drug, and only 1 death in the sparsentan group that they thought might be related to the trial drug itself. But otherwise, that was it. We could probably keep going in supplementals for a couple more hours, but those
were a long supplement. The biggest ones.
Yeah.
There were lots of insignificant results in the supplement. That's the conclusion. They tested many possible outcomes. None worked.
It's funny because it's probably my favorite part of the paper now is to go through all those details now that I have done it a couple times. Yeah, even if it's non-significant, it's still kind of important to see what other people are talking about behind the scenes, obviously, not necessarily the ones that make it through to the paper. I think results-wise, I think that's it, unless there's anything that I missed. Anyone else wanted to mention anything?
No, I don't think you missed anything.
So what's going on, Michelle, now? There's an open label extension?
There's an open label extension for DUPLEX. Kind of the company's working on putting a package together for the FDA to see if this is enough to get an indication for FSGS.
Just because if it's an orphan drug mm-hmm. and the proteinuria, is that the mm-hmm. hope that if FDA will ignore the lack of signal from GFR slope and maybe they may look favorably at
it? It's worth a try. I think because there's so few options for these patients mm-hmm. that even if this is a drug that, you know, causes a complete remission and 20% of patients, maybe that's enough for a disease like FSGS. And maybe we'll learn more in the follow-up studies about who might benefit the most. You know, maybe it's patients with genetic FSGS. Maybe it's patients with a lot of proteinuria are going to have the most benefit. Maybe we'll find something in the subgroup analyses.
And Michelle, the open label extension is everyone receives the sparsentan, right? It's not.
You lose the active control group, so you won't have that comparison anymore. So you'll have a lot of safety data and you'll have some, you'll have the long-term outcome data, but you won't have anything to compare it to. So it's not like we just are extending the study, which would have been great, but.
It'll look like the rest of the FSGS data that we have, which is all observational. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I mean, the crux of this study, the thing that's really disturbing is, since I've been a fellow, everything I've learned about FSGS is you need to reduce the proteinuria, and that's going to help your patients. And that's every time the patients come to clinic, we check the PCR, and we tell them they're doing good when the proteinuria is going down, and we talk about changing therapies when the proteinuria goes up. And here we have a study that shows a pretty significant, though not as much as they had hoped for, reduction in proteinuria, and we don't get the outcome that we need. You know, and all I do is I look at that inaxaplin study that we were super excited about, APOL1, and all they showed was a reduction in proteinuria because it was 16 patients and there was no control group and it was only how many weeks long. And we were super excited. Oh, we have something for APOL1, but all it does is reduce proteinuria. And, you know, maybe a little bit better. That was, I think it was a 50% reduction in proteinuria, not much different than what we have here. And 2 years later, no difference in EGFR slope. It's concerning.
I was going to say, I haven't called this out yet, or considered sparsentan out, because as Brandon was mentioning earlier, that 2 years of the slope GFR difference may not have been enough. I think it may not have been enough because of that big acute drop in GFR that we see with sparsentan. All of the results were consistently better with sparsentan, even if not statistically improved. All of the
point
composite outcomes, all of the proteinuria outcomes, everything showed a benefit with sparsentan, just not.
Yeah, which is why I asked about the open label extension period, because there's just a little bit there that suggests maybe there might be something. And you look at a couple of other trials testing on, and which is, you know, the observational follow-up, post-trial follow-up of steroids in IgA and EMPA-KIDNEY has observational post-trial follow-up. There is no active control in the follow-up. That allows you to then look at maybe with a bit more time, does the treatment effect emerge? But it's a bit more difficult it's impossible when you have an open label extension period. So I would like to see in some more of these shorter GN trials, rather than an open label extension, just observational follow-up. See if you follow people for longer, does the treatment effect emerge? I think there's a real opportunity for other studies going forward. I'm interested in your thoughts on that, Michelle, because I'm just not a big fan of open label extension periods. I know that with a rare disease like FSGS, part of the incentive for patients is to go into the trial is, oh, you're going to get the active drug later on. But I really question that motivation, because you don't know whether or not the investigational treatment is going to work or not. And it's better that we get a clear answer. So interested in your thoughts on that, Michelle.
I agree with you that I think that's a big motivator for patients. I've had some studies that I've been involved with where there hasn't been an open label extension at the beginning and patients have been hesitant because they don't want to get the placebo arm. And in this study, there was an active control, although it was, only an angiotensin receptor blocker. So people weren't too excited to think that they'd be on that for 2 years, and really wanted to get the other drug. But so I see where you're coming from, where, we may not get the best data from that kind of study, but we do, we do get the longer term safety data. And I think that's important too with some of these newer drugs.
Addressing your point, Joel, about proteinuria and kidney outcomes, there are two other interventions which reduce proteinuria but don't reduce kidney outcomes. One is dual RAS blockade.
Yep.
Combining ACE inhibitors with ARBs.
Say vitamin D. Please say vitamin D. Doesn't vitamin D reduce proteinuria? Am I right about that one?
I think I had seen something somewhere. Yeah, I'm sure it does
something not important. Study. Okay, yes.
Diltiazem, so, what do you got? What else?
Sorry?
Diltiazem, yeah. The non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Diltiazem. Also reduce proteinuria.
Diltiazem, verapamil, yeah.
Michelle, now that now that we're done here, what was more nerve-wracking, being on the main stage at Kidney Week during late breaking with thousands of people, or being on an international podcast that tens of people listen to?
Dozens on big
on the best day. On the best day.
There are dozens.
There are dozens.
Podcast is the most nerve-wracking, because you guys all know your stuff.
Well, we put on a good show. So,
so where do we go next, Michelle, with FSGS? Where are the next group of trials going? What are the next steps?
Yeah. You know, I think before we even go on to whatever the next trials are, we have to figure out what the right outcome is that we're going to be looking at. Is slope GFR the right primary outcome for patients with FSGS? I'm a little bit skeptical. And NephCure is putting together conference. They already had their first meeting. They're going to have a second meeting, I think, in June in Iceland, if there's not a volcano that's erupting there. And they are going to, you know, really look, dig into the evidence and see, is slope GFR the right endpoint? And I think once we have that kind of background, we'll be able to design trials a little bit smarter.
I think we just need to lean into the fact this is the kind of a first in FSGS to do a real randomized blinded clinical trial of significant size, multi-center, like just it's all, if you look at the data, it's 20 person RCTs of cyclosporin versus steroids. Like it's all small, 60 people here, an observational series that was done over 10 years at one center. I mean, that's what we've built our evidence base in FSGS. And you look at this, and this is just a, like I said, a modern, comprehensive database that we can kind of hang our hat on and we at least know some things.
And I've heard a lot of comments, you know, after this paper came out that, you know, we really shouldn't be doing these studies if we don't know the exact population of patients that we're including. So if it's not a pure primary FSGS, whatever that is, you know, that you shouldn't do the trial because it's just too messy. But I think it does the patients a disservice if we, you know, if we wait until we, you know, have a perfect pathophysiological understanding of FSGS. Because then, you know, it's going to be, I don't know, 50 years from now when we know. I've been doing this for 30 years and we don't know any more now than we did 30 years ago.
We know nothing.
You know nothing, Joltoff.
I know.
It's okay. All the supplemental, that's why.
Anybody else have any closing thoughts? I think I feel I've gotten my piece out.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really well done trial. I think kudos to... I'm not saying this because Michelle's here, but this was the largest FSGS trial. It sets the stage for doing more trials in FSGS now, right? It's made possible. You have shown that it's possible to do large multi-center RCTs in FSGS. So, you know, even if this didn't work out in terms of GFR slope, I hope this sets the stage for many more trials and something will pan out.
I will tell you that hearing Michelle say that she doesn't think slope is the right way to go makes it sound like we're headed back towards larger, longer trials. And that's going to be a hard sell for drug companies, right? If they like part of the, it sounds like from what Michelle was saying at the beginning, part of the enticement was we could use slope, we could get away with 300 patients. And then after the end of the trial, she's like, well, I'm not sure if slope's really what it's going to take. And we might be back to 40% doubling.
But you could go to proteinuria.
Well, I think proteinuria, honestly, after seeing this trial, proteinuria is I'm really questioning it. You're going to have to do the, I think this kind of forces you to do the longer trial, right? To show that proteinuria really is a good surrogate. Michelle, am I mischaracterizing your position?
Point taken.
Nope, that is <that's> correct.
Okay. Brendan, any other thoughts on proteinuria and slope in FSGS?
Overall, Michelle, if you don't dichotomize the outcome, what was it? It was a 25% reduction in proteinuria over 108 weeks. Is that right?
For the sparsentan, 50% reduction, and for irbesartan, about 25, I think.
Yeah.
So 25% difference.
Yeah, so 25% mm-hmm. difference. That's pretty moderate. So perhaps you just need, you need a larger reduction in proteinuria. 25% is not a very large reduction in proteinuria. In relative terms, so maybe you need a larger reduction in certain disease states to translate to a benefit on the clinical outcome. I'm not sure. I've heard some people speculate about that, so perhaps that's one explanation. But I do think that, you know, I'm a little bit uncomfortable about proteinuria as the sole, as a surrogate endpoint for drug approval for all the reasons that Joel has mentioned. I think, you know, rate of change, however you calculate it, rate of change in GFR, absolute change in GFR, all of those things are directly on the causal pathway to kidney failure and probably preferable compared to proteinuria. But just we need to find the best way to calculate that and know that the best time frames over which to evaluate that.
Okay, excellent. Michelle, this has been an awesome trial. I honestly, I think you've done a huge service to the nephrology community. And I think anybody that looks at this and just looks at this trial and just says it's a negative trial and doesn't understand the significance of what you have accomplished is really missing the point here. Great work.
Yeah. And I think there's something to learn from every trial, whether it's positive or negative. You know, you learn so much, even just if we learn that we can do a trial in FSGS, as Swap said earlier.
Totally.
That's important. Yeah.
I think this Excellent. Is
congratulations on this.
This is huge. It's going to be great, and we're going to see so many more GN trials going forward. FSGS, IgA, even other rarer GNs, MPGN, complement mediated diseases. This is a really exciting time. I think Duplex really sets that up.
Excellent. Tubular secretions. Swap. What have you been watching?
Yeah, so when it comes to science fiction or science fantasy books being converted into TV series, I've been extremely disappointed with both with Foundation, which was Asimov and Apple TV, and with Wheel of Time, which was Robert Jordan and Prime. But both of them came back with season two, and I was being, you know, a masochist as is. I watched season two of both of them. And season two were way better. So I'm really happy that I watched Foundation as well as Wheel of Time. It drifts further away from the books. And maybe then you forget the fact that the books exist and you watch them as, you know, independent, you know, in a similar world. Yeah. So if anyone stopped watching Foundation after season one, I would recommend you go back and see season two. And same for Wheel of Time on Prime.
Okay. Excellent. I will watch.
I know. I like to get
I will
more
watch
than one.
Season two then. You convinced me.
I thought season two Foundation was quite good. Yeah, big fan. Excellent. Priya,
so
what do you got?
I will talk about a book that I'm currently reading. I do a lot of fiction and stuff, but I'm actually in the middle of a nonfiction book. It's called Poverty by America. It's by, let's see, Matthew Desmond. He's this sociologist, just essentially going over the history of our economy as a U.S., kind of overview of poverty and how things in regards to policy making and changes have happened over the last couple decades. I'm about halfway through right now, so he's still on the history part of it, but I'm excited to see what he has in terms of the future of policy making. He's well known for one of his other books called Evicted. It came back several years ago, so eventually I'll pick that one up, but so far, it's a good read. If there are any newbies out there that kind of just want to know about socioeconomics of this topic. So I recommend it so far. I'm not done
Excellent.
Yet, so.
Excellent. The name of the book again is Poverty America?
It's Poverty, comma, by America.
By America. Mm-hmm. Okay. Excellent. Poverty by America. Nayan, what do you got?
Yeah, so over the holidays, I read Armor of Light, which is the fifth Ken Follett book in his Kingsbridge series. So this started back in 1989. He wrote Pillars of the Earth that started in the 12th century. And so these are historical fiction books. This one now is up to the late 17, early 1800s and centers around the invention of the spinning jenny and how that impacted manufacturing and the people that worked in the mills and led to the Luddites who then smashed all these machines because they were concerned about employment. It's on the background of Napoleon, the War of 1812. So it's a pretty expansive book, but he's really, really good at character development and telling stories and kind of a good read when you have
Pillars of the Earth, one of the great novels of all time. Excellent. Okay. The name of the book again is?
This one is Armor of Light.
Armor of Light. Brendan, what do you got?
I might be a bit late to it, but I'm going to spend the next week watching Andor, the Star Wars one of the-
Oh, so good.
Highly, highly recommended. Yeah.
So I'm glad that you guys have seen it and recommend it.
Stellan Skarsgård is magnificent. I think it's the best. Mandalorian came close season one, but I thought Andor was
even way better than Mandalorian. Absolutely. Good. You're in for a treat. Excellent. Yeah.
With no Jedi, right? There are no Jedi. It's a Star Wars thing with zero Jedi and zero Sith, but still it's just fantastic storytelling.
Yes. Michelle, what do you got?
So I just finished reading Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. That is a book about a woman who's in the 50s, who's a chemist, and about the sexism that she encounters and of her relationships and how she eventually gets.
Good thing we don't have that anymore.
Exactly. It's all gone. So, and then it's also a nice 8-part series on Apple TV. So watch that too, since I had some free time.
Excellent.
I think it's got Brie Larson.
How does the television series compare to the book?
You know, they make some changes to it, but overall, I think it stays true to the story.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Hey, guys, thank you very much. Do not close your browser, especially Brendan, who is only 33% uploaded. Are you hotspotting this on your phone, or are you sending this via Morse code? What's going on, Brendan?
Carrier pigeon should be uploaded in
carrier pigeon spot. Okay, I am stopping the recording.